This is The Guardian.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and after a couple of weeks off, welcome back to Full Story Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. When Scott Morrison left Australia to attend the Global Climate Summit in Glasgow, he left prepared to defend Australia's checkered position on global heating.
Australia meets and beats our commitments, and we are doubling our initial climate finance commitment.
But before he even touched down, the Prime Minister found himself performing damage control over the cancelled submarine contract with the French.
President Macron told a couple of us around the corner that you didn't tell him the truth on the subs deal. In fact, he said that you might have lied. Is that true?
No.
As Morrison rubbed shoulders with world leaders, his failures on climate policy were quickly trumped by his failures at international diplomacy.
He said that what happened was detrimental to your reputation. What do you say to that?
I'll always stand up for Australia's interests.
Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tischer about Scott Morrison's leadership on the global stage. It's Friday, the 5th of November. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning.
Okay, so Scott Morrison has been overseas this past week. Lenore, can you set the scene? Give us the highlights of what's happened.
Yeah, sure. It really didn't turn out as Scott Morrison probably anticipated. I think he went away thinking his biggest problem was going to be not having a credible climate policy, but turned out he had a whole lot more problems than that. It started just as he was boarding the plane for Rome in the G20, when he had what I guess you could euphemistically call a full and frank conversation with Emmanuel Macron, the first since the subs deal, the $90 billion submarine contract, was cancelled. Macron was quite forthright. And you can sort of see Morrison thinking at that point, okay, this isn't great, but at least it's sort of got it out of the way before my trip starts. But then the first stop was Rome. US President Joe Biden and Macron had a bilateral meeting where Biden sort of threw Morrison under the bus.
What happened was, to use an English phrase, what we did was clumsy. It was not done with a lot of grace.
And said that he had thought that France had been informed before the subs deal, which obviously France said it wasn't, and that's the sort of one of the great things that France is so offended about. So at that point, you can sort of think, okay, Morrison's thinking, oh God, it's not gone away yet. So there was no bilateral meeting scheduled between Morrison and Macron, but then Morrison's office sort of popped up to tell the travelling reporters that Morrison and Macron had this great friendly conversation in the leaders' lounge where, you know, no reporters were present.
I had the opportunity to see President Macron today and we exchanged our greetings and shook hands. He was having a chat to someone. I went up and just put my arm in his shoulder.
Now, Morrison went up to Macron and said, g'day, Emmanuel, and how much he looked forward to catching up with him in the next couple of days. And Deirdre Chambers, what a coincidence. The Prime Minister's official photographer was right there to get a photo of this wonderful rapprochement. Macron, it's got to be said, didn't look that enthusiastic. But anyway, there was a picture. So you can sort of think then Morrison's thinking, okay, phew, it's done now. But then the pesky Australian reporters doorstopped Macron.
News for credibility and of Australia, and a very bad news for...
And asked him what he thought and whether he thought Morrison had lied to him about the subs deal.
So I had a very direct discussion with Prime Minister Morrison about this issue.
Do you think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
And he said the immortal words, I don't think. I know. And so that kind of brought it into full damage control mode for the Prime Minister. And he started at that point taking some quite controversial actions.
I'm not going to cop sledging at Australia. I'm not going to cop that on behalf of other Australians. I can deal with whatever people throw at me.
Including, it would appear, leaking a private text from the French president.
Prime Minister, should world leaders feel safe to send you messages from now on? Because this is the claim from the French ambassador back in Canberra that they might now have concerns those messages might be leaked.
So really the whole trip this submarine issue followed him from Australia to Rome to Glasgow. And in fact, then when he flew home, he sort of landed to the news of what the French ambassador had been saying at the press club, which was also, you know, highly critical.
A stab in the back to turn its back on our solemn and far-reaching partnership without ever frankly consulting with France is just out of this world.
So, you know, the Prime Minister's been in submarine damage control all week, which I don't think is what he anticipated.
I think the French ambassador called the leaking of the text an unprecedented new low.
The second thing concerning the leaks, this is an unprecedented new low.
Mm.
Lenore, Scott Morrison took a long time to decide whether he'd go on this trip. Do you think he regrets it?
Oh, I bet he does. You know, overseas trips are always risky for prime ministers because they can't control the story or the response that they will get. They generally take reporters along with them who are scrutinising their every move, who are there day and night all the time. They usually try to pre-plan announceables so that they kind of control the narrative. But as we have discussed, Scott Morrison's announceables basket was a little bit bare going to Glasgow. So it was a high-risk endeavour. And, yeah, one could say that the risk turned out to be acute.
How is it possible, once a series of events like this has gone on, which is a bit of a disaster after disaster, is it possible for Morrison to ever get the narrative back on his side? Mike?
Firstly, it seems odd that he hadn't anticipated that this would happen a bit more before leaving for Europe. He was obviously going to meet Macron or come across Macron there. Questions would be asked about the deal, the subs deal, as well as all everything that was happening at the COP. So it seems a little odd that they hadn't prepared a strategy. He probably didn't expect Joe Biden to come out and say, oh, yeah, I think the French knew. didn't know the French hadn't been informed. That was particularly unhelpful for Morrison. And is perhaps in a way more significant in the long term than the row with France. But it seems strange that he hadn't prepared a sort of, oh, yeah, look, it could have been handled better. Sorry about that, France. You know, we're still very firm friends. Let's sort of kick off on a new foot before it all got completely out of hand in the way that it did. But in the short term, Morrison sort of played it for domestic political advantage, I suppose, to the best he can by sort of standing up for Australia, if you want to put it that way, and hoping that people don't mind too much that we've put France's noses very much out of joint. And maybe that will work for him domestically, but, you know, the scale of it seems to be pretty avoidable.
Apart from Biden kind of landing Australia in it, he did kind of profusely apologise. Has Morrison apologised in that way before, Lenore?
No, not really. And I think this is part of the problem that the French have, is that Australia seems entirely unrepentant and unwilling to say that they've done anything wrong. In fact, that Australia sort of changed its story a bit over the weeks since the subs deal was announced. So initially they conceded that when Morrison and Macron had dinner at the Elysee Palace in June, which is where Morrison says, you know, Macron should have picked up on the fact that things were problematic, they were saying, look, he had conveyed serious concerns.
There were still things to resolve, but I'm confident we would have been able to resolve them. But it was our concerns over the early delays and the delivery, particularly on things like Australian industry contact.
And clearly, from everything that ensued after that, Macron knew there were serious concerns, but he didn't for a minute think those serious concerns might mean that Australia was simultaneously negotiating a whole different subs deal and was going to just ditch his sort of overnight one day. Now Morrison is saying that he told Macron a conventional submarine was not going to meet Australia's strategic interests. So Morrison is sort of, I guess, slightly changing and upping the ante on what he said to Macron to try to justify how Australia played it. I think it's quite obvious that Australia had a dual track system going on, a dual track strategy going on, where they were trying to negotiate this AUKUS deal and the separate nuclear submarines deal, but they were continuing with the negotiations and the whole contract with France. And they hadn't told the French that it was over. In fact, the fellow in defence who was in charge of that entire contract, a man called Greg Sammet, told Estimates a while ago that almost at that same time, he was telling the French that, in fact, they had presented an affordable and acceptable offer and they were ready to proceed with the next phase of work. So I think it's quite understandable why the French at least thought that they were getting mixed messages at that point and didn't clock to the fact that Australia was just going to ditch them overnight in a live stream global event with, you know, Boris Johnson and Joe Biden at separate podia. That really, all the evidence suggests that wasn't clearly communicated, and that's why France is so upset. Now, obviously, there's diplomatic positioning going on both sides, and obviously the French have a domestic audience to which they're also playing. That's clear. But I think the way Scott Morrison handled it as the temperature rose over the past week, particularly the leaking of private conversations and text messages between him and the president, takes it to a whole new level. I think that takes it beyond the normal tit-for-tat rhetoric to a real issue that could have wider ramifications for people trusting Australia.
If we go back to June as well, when the G, whatever it was, seven met in Cornwall in the UK, and Morrison said he had really positive discussions with Macron about the, including about the subs contract, and talked about how they had a very open and transparent and friendly relationship and can speak candidly to each other about these issues and how great that was. I mean, that's the public statement. And at that time, Morrison already clearly knew he was negotiating the AUKUS deal. So you can really understand why, both in private and public utterances from Australia, the French are particularly upset.
Just on the ramifications that you just mentioned, Lenore, what are they? Like, will this have an effect on the EU free trade deal, for example, that Australia is trying to negotiate?
Well, that does have seem to have sort of put on the go slow track. The French are about to take over the EU presidency. I mean, I don't know that we should overstate those things. I mean, countries kind of continue to act in their own national interest, and I assume that those relationships will get back on track. I do think that the willingness of Scott Morrison to leak a private correspondence is the most likely to be the biggest ongoing issue for Australia. But, you know, if there's an issue in the EU like, you know, carbon tariffs, for example, or other things, you know, the French are probably slightly less likely to go into bat for us now than they would have before. You know, I do think at the edges it will have ongoing ramifications, yeah.
Labor has taken the line that this really goes to Morrison's character, that he is untrustworthy. How do you think that plays domestically?
I'm not sure how it plays domestically. It certainly does seem to be a pattern. I think maybe to start with, like, politicians and also diplomats in international negotiations, obviously they can't be completely candid all the time about everything that's going on. People do sort of speak in euphemisms and half-truths sometimes when they can't be completely upfront about everything all the time. But I think more to the point of Morrison is that he does that, but then he never admits it. He never takes responsibility for having said the wrong thing or having outright misdirected in some cases. I think the Crikey website has been keeping a log of all the times when it alleges he has done that, which is very handy. And it's just like most of them are, could be regarded as relatively trivial, but it does seem to be a pattern that he really finds it hard to say, yeah, look, I stuffed up, or that wasn't, or to row back on something that he said that he knew he couldn't say the whole truth at some point. And I think that's more where Labour is going, is that he just can't say sorry. He just can't admit a mistake or just sticks to his guns completely unless he's forced to apologise for some completely egregious thing.
And it's not just Labour, is it? A former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, has kind of backed the French and said quite explicitly that Scott Morrison is known for lies and that he can't be trusted.
I mean, it is just bullshit. Oh, he's lied to me on many occasions. I mean, there's quite a few examples in my book, but Scott has always had a reputation for telling lies.
Is that more damaging in a way than Labour's attack?
I think it's one of the many downsides of having had so many leadership changes at the top of Australian politics in the last decade, that there's always a former Prime Minister ready to step up and say something unhelpful to the current one, whether it's Turnbull, Kevin Rudd or Tony Abbott, who've all excelled in that department in the past few months. You know, maybe Julia Gillard is setting the standard here for staying out of all these rows. Whether that Turnbull hurts Morrison more, I mean, I think it's kind of what you would expect His attacks are getting more pointed, I think, but whether people are listening to Turnbull any more now than they did previously, I think they would. No one thinks Turnbull is going to say nice things about Scott Morrison now. So I'm not sure if that adds too much to I don't think Scott Morrison will be worrying too much about the fact that it's coming from him.
I just think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, in that Labor's trying to sort of channel it into that view that Morrison is untrustworthy, which has been their attack line for quite a long time. Scott Morrison sort of enthusiastically, it must be said, endorsed by a lot of the News Corp columnists, is pushing very hard on the line that he was just sticking up for Australia, that in fact his interests here and the national interest are entirely aligned, and that if you question him, you're sort of questioning Australia's interests. I don't think that's true, in that I think his responses and his leaking were entirely about his own personal political interest, and that, and as I've said, I think the leaking could actually be quite detrimental to Australia's national interest. But it will be interesting to see whether that kind of idea sticks, and I think that's the danger for Labor as it pushes forward with its attack.
It was very clear from the French response that they meant him, not Australia.
Yeah, and they spelt that out in words of one syllable. Yeah. You know, Macron kept going back to it. I think the Australian people are great.
I mean, when you leak something, if you want to disguise who it comes from, you have to leak something that has many authors or many people mm-hmm. have seen. But in this case, it was a personal text message to Scott Morrison. So it was pretty clear that he was fine for everyone to understand that he was the person who leaked it or allowed it to be leaked.
Mm. And Morrison hasn't even tried to deny leaking it at all.
There seems to be a bit of commentary that really it was like for like, that Macron was so brazen in calling Morrison a liar, that response was justified.
Well, I mean, as I've said, if Morrison responded in an aggressive rhetorical manner, it would be like for like.
Mm.
Leaking private correspondent is not like for like. That's a whole nother level in my view.
Mm. It was very undiplomatic of Macron to call, that's not normal diplomatic behaviour either, to outright call another leader, a friendly leader, a liar. It's been the unwillingness to sort of douse the flames, but just keep ratcheting it up with every new provocation. It's like Morrison seems unwilling to ever put a lid on it and say, look, okay. Mm. I mean, finally he said it's time to move on, but only after he'd had what he would have thought of as the last word, which turned out not to be the last word, because then the ambassador had another shot the next day.
And it goes to his leadership, doesn't it? He's faced several crises in his prime ministership, the bushfires, the COVID crisis, the vaccine rollout, and he seems to have not stepped up in a way that we often expect leaders to at those times. Is that fair to say, Lenore?
I think the most consequential example of Scott Morrison not stepping up was the other thing that happened this week, which was him going to the Glasgow conference with no new 2030 target, which is what the Glasgow conference was about. And then all the other things that happened in Glasgow, which sort of got overshadowed by the tit for tat with Macron, like we signed on to a declaration to end global deforestation, but seem to think that it's got nothing to do with native logging here. We refused to sign on to a global pledge to cut emissions of methane, which is probably because our emissions of methane are projected to stay exactly the same for the next decade, which is probably because we're expanding gas wells and not necessarily implementing all of the things that we could to reduce methane from livestock. So at every front in Glasgow, we were like a no-show. And that, given the importance of the issue, that to me is the greatest abrogation of leadership possible.
Next, Cleo Smith and Christmas in a Can. Now we come to what we can't get out of our head. Let's start with you, Lenore.
Oh, Cleo Smith, honestly, what a moment. I can't get it out of my head. The whole world can't get it out of their heads. The story has a way to run. There's things we don't know, but just the fact that she was found alive after all that time and apparently well was just yeah, it was a very joyful moment.
Mm. It's hard to find a more joyful moment than that, Mike. So I'm relying on you to lower the tone instead.
Thank you.
What can you get out of your head?
So my story this week is one that falls into one of my favourite genres, which is basically Britain parodying itself, apparently. And it's one about Heinz, the food company, has released what they call a Christmas dinner in a can. It's a limited edition release this Christmas. They're producing 500 to see how it goes.
What, the whole Christmas dinner?
It's a Christmas dinner big soup, which contains big chunks of turkey, pigs in blankets, Brussels sprouts, stuffing balls and potatoes with a gravy and cranberry sauce. And
All in a tin.
And I mean, make your Christmas dinner, I don't know what will.
I'm so glad I don't have to cook this year.
Right, well, that's your Christmas sorted then, Mike.
I just wanted to mention a previous story because it falls into the same category, I think, which was that in some British supermarkets, because of the shortages there, this is also a sort of been touted as a, you know, if you can't get all the things in the British supermarkets because of the soup shortages, you can have your Christmas dinner in a can. But the previous story was that there's so many empty shelves that they're making cardboard cutouts of vegetables and things to put on the shelves to make it look like there are actually vegetables on the shelves.
That sounds like when I went to Eastern Europe before the fall of the wall.
Sounds very much like that. Sorry, Britain. I know things are not going that well, and sympathies to all my friends in Britain, but
they've got Christmas dinner in a can.
Christmas dinner in a can.
Okay, thank you so much, Lenore and Mike, for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Gabs.
This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannan. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you again on Monday. I hope you have a great weekend and we'll see you then. Tomorrow, we'll be playing our new culture podcast, Save for Later, in the Full Story feed. Don't forget to check it out. And if you like it, which I'm sure you will, I love it, subscribe in the Save for Later feed.